So we try to allow for places of contemplation. Try to allow for places for conversation. We try to create programming that supports sort of processing of a new perspective.
That was Maria Hain, president of the Museum of Science and History of Jacksonville. Maria is our guest for episode 7 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview.
Everyone, I want you to welcome Maria Hain to our latest episode of Innovate Jax. Maria, welcome to the interview.
Thank you, Kate. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
We are thrilled to have you, and you come from a new sector for us with Innovate Jax. We've talked to some leaders in the business field, and we've talked to some really motivational folks, and now we're going more into the cultural aspect of Jacksonville. And you are the president of the Museum of Science and History of Jacksonville, so I know you have so much to say, and can't wait to dig into your background and just get your thoughts on so many different things. So let's get started.
Okay, sounds great.
So Maria, I want to start off with the fact that you are an Osprey. You graduated summa cum laude from the University of North Florida. And so that makes me ask, are you a Jacksonville native?
I am not, although I will say that my father's family goes several generations back in Jacksonville. I'm here more by accident, but I was born in Gainesville. So I'm a Florida native.
Yes, you
and
are.
And do have family in Jacksonville, so it's convenient that I'm here, but more by accident.
Okay, all right. So what made you choose UNF then?
So I had my first go at college was at Flagler.
Okay.
And so I was at Flagler and I studied psychology and Spanish as a double major. Have no idea what I thought I was going to do with that. But went back to school at Flagler after I worked outside of school for a couple of years. And really kind of that was working through retail was really where I figured out what I did not want to do with my life and had a real clarity of vision in my mid-20s that I wanted to work in the nonprofit sector. And so with that very strong clarity and a real set of values, then I went to UNF, finished up my degree there in communications and public relations.
And then, boy, did you put it to work, because I see that you were, for Mayor John Delaney, you were the director of written communications for him.
Yes.
I was wondering, you know, what was it like for you to serve Jacksonville from a public office in those years? You said that you were drawn to, you know, kind of the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. Why start your professional life in public service?
Well, I actually was at the American Lung Association and worked in Springfield Neighborhood Housing Services. So I was in community development and housing prior to, and I'd started a relationship with the mayor's office through that community development work. I actually started a nonprofit while I was doing that work when I was home with having babies. I wasn't very good at staying home. So started a nonprofit, started that relationship with the mayor's office through that work. And so working in as a public servant was very much aligned with the same values that drove, you know, me and to work in the nonprofit. And I think it rounded out beautifully the nonprofit career piece, because you really, when you understand how government works and the relationship of nonprofit and government serving people together, I think it makes it much more well-rounded. As well, you understand where funding comes from, you understand how to truly make impact. So working in the mayor's office and with John Delaney and Audrey Moran and some of the folks that I worked with there, you know, really shaped me as a leader. And I certainly learned a lot, but some of the things that you wouldn't think about working with Sam Moussa, I learned so much on the Better Jacksonville Plan about construction and about the process of project management. And so I had the opportunity to work so intimately with those, even though you would think being in communications, that might not have tapped into it, but we were communicating. Our communications team, we were communicating on behalf of the construction managers and the engineers and the government. So there's a very different way to take that language and that vocabulary and speak to neighborhoods and communicate directly with the people that are being served or impacted through that kind of work. So The idea of learning so much about the processes really ended up serving me beautifully when I was both at JTA, but more so when I moved into museum work at the Comer, because I oversaw many capital projects there and was one of the few people to kind of really understand the construction process. So when I did project management on behalf of the Comer, then I had a kind of on the ground knowledge base already, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
So it's not something that you would think came out of. And then, of course, there's so many other things, but I always am grateful to look back and see how those things that you're picking up along the way are really those things that add up to your experience levels to do something you could never have imagined before, like building a new museum.
So it was really a whole other education, wasn't it?
Yeah.
On top of your degree and having that exposure. All right, so let's move then into that next phase. You had already indicated working for the Comer. Okay, so now you went from a public office. You started first with nonprofit. You went into the public space. Now you're going into kind of a different avenue. What brought you to the Comer?
So when I was in the mayor's office, anything, I guess, that looked like art, they just gave to me. So I served on the cultural council, the cultural services grant panel. I oversaw the mayor's art collection up there. Sat in for Audrey Moran at the library. Did a lot of work on, of course, in the Better Jacksonville Plan on through the public arts funding, and so there was a lot of intersections there already. And is arts and culture was just a passion of mine and a place that I came from anyway. And so so when I went to work at the Comer, I think that was where I really found that what I define as success, where your passion and your skill set collide or come together. And that's just that place of success that you love what you do, you're passionate about what you do, and you have a skill set to serve it well. And so I think I've really found that at the Comer.
You mentioned, you know, your construction, you know, fluency really came into play with the Comer. What did you do for the organization? And I'll mention that your title there, you were Deputy Director of Operations the Comer. So what all did you do?
Yeah. So when I first came to the Comer, it was as a marketing, I don't remember, Director of Marketing. Pretty quickly within that first year, I became assistant to the director and then fairly swiftly moved into overseeing the operations. So it was, so I oversaw all of the operations of the Comer. The pieces that were not under that umbrella were curatorial and education. And so, so within that realm, there were two capital projects. One was about a little over $1 million transformation of New American Gallery for Art. And so oversaw that project and the overall capital project, and then took on the project management over the larger capital project at the time. This was what was then the Women's Club and how that was integrating into the campus and the campus master planning, rebranding. So it was a pretty extensive role in that regard. I think about 65% of my time when we were active on that project was dedicated to the capital and the construction piece of it. So that's where I really felt like so much of what I had been introduced to during, you know, almost just not by planning, but just in doing the daily work through the Better Jacksonville Plan and through that work really translated into a fluency, as you said, when I was working on these capital projects. And then certainly that that became very essential to coming to work at MOSH and looking at deferred maintenance and how do we bring this museum up to a place that everybody can be proud of, and then how do we look forward to growth.
Okay, well, that's so perfect lead-in for folks. Obviously, the role that you're in today, you are the president of MOSH, and you took that helm back in June of 2009.
Right.
So you have been guiding the growth and development of one of Jacksonville's downtown cultural anchors. You know, take us from 2009 to today. You know, you went through a recession. You know, you went through hurricanes. You went through explosive growth in this city. What's the role that Mosh is really meant to play here in the city?
Yeah, I love that question. We are a critical part of downtown development, especially launching this project, Mosh 2.0, critical part of downtown development, critical part of our education and the STEM or STEAM, so science, technology, education, and math, critical partner in that ecosystem to build a fluency, a literacy of technology within the STEM fields for our workforce for tomorrow for Jacksonville. So this is a shared goal that is across the board from the chamber to, you know, City Hall to our corporations. Everybody's looking at how are we building that workforce for tomorrow so we can be competitive. So we play a really critical role in that informal science learning. Studies show that about 97% of our learning of science is done through informal settings. And so that is outside of classroom settings. So it's really that hands-on experiential learning that we bring all of that to life. So we are a downtown development project. We are a critical project for education, our critical programming for education and for workforce development, and even as a regional destination for tourism, driving tourism, cultural tourism, ecotourism. These are the real hot spots for tourism across for that market. So we play a really important role in Jacksonville, being one of those anchor institutions that why would you come to Jacksonville? What are you going to do when you get here? So we're, you know, part of a really, really outstanding group of other institutions of the Zoo, the Kummer, MoCA, Symphony, Mosh. You know, Jacksonville's lucky that we have these really foundational institutions. So it's you know, it's critical for Jacksonville to support that and help us all to grow stronger. So we bring more people to Jacksonville who want to stay here.
So Maria, you know, as someone who brought her own children to this museum countless times, for the experience,
thank you.
And know what they got from it. With the exhibits that you have and this exposure to science, as you said, okay, so it's an obvious link for younger generations and creating the workforce of tomorrow, but is there anything that Mosh provides for kind of the current workplace generation? How is it that you're helping to build their skill sets so that they're also competitive and helping Jacksonville compete?
Yeah. Well, depends. There's a couple of answers, I think, to that. One, if we take a look at young professionals in Jacksonville, what is attracting, what is the quality of life that we have here, and what are their expectations that they would want to come here to work to help create the workforce. Right now we're having to recruit to Jacksonville for this workforce. So having vibrant science museums, having vibrant, you know, places like Mosh are so important for recruiting new and good talent, for workplace development. Where do you choose to start your family? We want people to grow up here and stay here, right? And then we want people to come here and stay here and start their families here and invest in our city and our community. So this becomes another critical tool for why would somebody want to stay? Why would somebody want to raise their kids here? Us being a great partner to our school system, both the charter schools, the public schools, the private schools. So you see so much of our work really is blended and integrated into our school systems as
right.
well, even in the surrounding counties. So I think there's one more kind of nut to that is it's really cool to be a science nerd right now. And so adults are seeking out learning, not just learning opportunities, but fun opportunities, fun experiences to do that are with their children and without their children. And so we see about 57% of the people that come to Mosh are coming without children. So we really found an audience, a really ripe audience with adults and mostly young professionals, but not all. There is so when you look at our mission, we talk about lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. The way that we present our programming makes it appealing to certain programs, to adults, and then great programming for families so that caregivers can learn with their children. But I think having that, talking about, I think your question was,
what's special about MOSH that we would help with the job work skills? I think when we're talking about adults, we're probably talking more about what places they can go, what makes their quality of life better here, so that they want to stay here.
Right. Yeah. But I think it's compelling too that 57% of your visitors are coming without children in tow. I don't think that would have been an obvious audience mix to me. So, you know, a day in the life of being president here. You know, let's talk about the exhibits that you curate. I mean, what is it that is a home run when you're considering future programming or future offerings? What makes for a great display or a great interactive piece?
There's a lot of questions in that.
Pick one.
What makes for a great experience? Like, what is the audience expecting? How do we meet the expectations of the audience that is aligned with our mission? And so, the Barnstormers are dinosaurs. We were very careful. We are very careful in curating our dinosaur exhibitions that we bring in, that we space them appropriately so that that's not all you ever see here, but it keeps people excited. I mean, it's but if you're thinking about what truly drives audience in the summer, dinosaurs, things with very big teeth. And it's so much fun to program them around it. I mean, that just makes programming so easy. There's another, so that's kind of the big audience grab, the popularity, the big thing. But then there's this other piece that drives audience, and it's the local connection. It's what really speaks specifically to our community, and where does our community see themselves reflected here? So we see, dinosaurs, you know, like I said, those are the Barnstormers. Those are knocking the doors down. But we also see that kind of connectivity and people, audience showing up when we're doing something specifically around our community, and we're including our community in the curatorial space. So the community we're including some of the collections. They're informing, you know, some of our didactics and some of the experiences that are around a local sort of based history exhibit. Or so an example is we just did a neighborhoods exhibit. So over 230 identified neighborhoods in Jacksonville. So that's to take a look at Jacksonville's history since consolidation over the last 50 years through the lens of our neighborhoods, really looking at what defines a sense of place and how do people connect with their neighborhoods. These are the places we go home to. And that really drove so many people here. And we had, you know, we had spaces for community groups to meet here while the exhibit was up. People can see themselves in the exhibit. It wasn't for, you know, for one culture or for one, didn't have just one lens. It was through the lens of the places we live, the places we love, the places we struggle in, or that we're trying to build and make better, or that, you know, are what we call home. So creating exhibits where people see themselves in it is the other place. So you have sort of those grand traveling exhibits, and then you have these very personal experiences that we create on behalf of the citizens and the residents of Jacksonville.
I'm so impressed that, you know, that you have that's so top of mind, that inclusivity and the participation from the community to help shape what museum and, you know, what the programming is and everything. And it shouldn't be a surprise to me to hear that, because in looking on your website and in preparing for our conversation today, I came across a policy statement and I'm just intrigued by it and really would love to hear more from you as president, Maria. The statement that reads, "We acknowledge inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility as drivers of institutional excellence." Can you expand on this policy?
Sure. Well, that policy reflects our values. So values are behaviors that are aligned with practices. So this is, if that is a value for us, we shorten it to IDEA. That's how we talk about it. Inclusivity, diversity, equity, and accessibility. So there's an internal team that is made up of a cross-section of different staff from, you know, all different areas in the museum that kind of keep it driving from the inside out. But it is inherent in what we do that everyone see themselves here. So if you look at our tagline, Curiosity Welcome, when we rebranded in our 75th year, we've been serving the community for 75 years continuously. When we rebranded 3 years ago, you couldn't imagine how much work went into two words, Curiosity Welcome. And our board, our stakeholders, this was a really important conversation around that. So curiosity implies that this is a relationship, that it's not a one-way delivery system of here, listen to us, or here, read this. It is curiosity. You bring your curiosity with you. So welcome is everybody sees themselves here. So that's our charge then. What does that look like? That means our programming, that people see themselves here through our programming. They see themselves here in our exhibits. So if you look over, you know, if you look at our exhibits coming up and in the past, we have the traveling exhibits, which are fun and broad but we have real opportunity in what we call our signature exhibits. Those are the ones that are curated from within our collections locally. I gave you the neighborhoods as an example of that. So this is where we really can speak to specific audiences and very specific communities. Programming is another example of that. We had the Taste of the Philippines, where we partnered with a Filipino community, and that was last October. It was such a wonderful event, but we have such a thriving Filipino community here. And so, where they could see themselves here for that entire day and night. And it was a celebration of food and culture that is very specific to them. Pride Day. We just had Pride Day last Saturday, and we've done that for 4 years now, and really developed a relationship with the LGBTQ community, African American community. We do very specific programming that speaks to that community, and that we invite that community in to help us to sculpt that and to present what is meaningful to them. The music choices, when we have, I don't know, just public programming, the choice of music that we play is even a signal to certain communities that they're welcome, or that we see them here, or they see themselves here or not. So everything that we do is with that lens of what are we saying, both to communities that we expect to come and to communities that may not be showing up. What are we saying with all of our choices? So and this is in our hiring practices. This isn't, you know, it's internal and it's external. So it's really a very foundational value for not just our museum, but for many museums. But this is really the place. And sometimes that means conflict, but that's okay. Everybody needs to see themselves here. And
well, Maria, you know, I congratulate you for modeling the way. I mean, you're really putting into practice the most democratizing approach to culture and holding up a mirror and making sure that everybody gets a chance to see themselves reflected back. So just what an outstanding, you know, for our city to own that sort of asset is just remarkable. So thank you for that. You know, and speaking about conflict, you know, what role might MOSH play? You know, you not only model the way, but helping other people maybe, I won't say come to consensus, but gain an understanding of someone's perspective that is not the one they currently hold. You know, we are in an age where even science is being called into question on a routine basis.
Yeah.
And it goes from there. So how can we use this resource, this remarkable place that we have, to help drive that understanding and maybe start to break down the resistance that others might feel in kind of holding on to a perspective that they feel is, you know, they don't want to allow challenge to it. So help me see what you can do.
So there might be some that don't want to allow. There might just be some that just aren't exposed to other perspectives. You know, we tend to live in neighborhoods with people that look like us. We tend to definitely go to church with people that look like us and think like us. We, you know, our social activities tend to, I'm not saying it's across, but we tend to people who think the way we do. So even our social media, the algorithms are programmed so that we get to hear more about people like us, and we love that, right?
The echo chamber, for sure.
Yeah. So the museum can be a place where you can come and have that exposure in a place that's not got a political agenda. It's not, got a faith-driven agenda. It's not driven by an agenda. It's presenting facts or it's presenting perspectives, so that you can have there is a space where you can contemplate that, or you can see something through someone else's eyes. We present a lot of our exhibits with that in mind. The Anne Frank exhibit and collaboration was a wonderful way for the community to come together, but it also brought in people who didn't agree with. Some people still think the Holocaust is a conspiracy theory. And we found that when people were going through and the docents and talking about, but having that exposure and seeing and being in a room with people that they could talk about that with, or that there were interactions. So some of it is designing the experience, understanding that someone may come in and have questions. Someone may come in and this is the first time they've seen a perspective different from theirs. So we really try to design the experience to allow for that, so that there are places when we have an exhibit or a program that might be challenging to someone's way of thinking or perspective. So we try to allow for places of contemplation, try to allow for places for conversation. We try to create programming that supports sort of a processing of a new perspective. So I can't say we always do it right, but we certainly we try to bring in experts, people who are different from us, so it really brings, there's a great opportunity for collaboration, but that makes it a much richer experience that's far more well thought out to accommodate the visitor and them leaving with a very positive experience, or one that they felt like they're leaving with something they didn't come with in a good way.
Well, it sounds like such a respectful approach to you're not here, as you said, it's not a one-way bullhorn. You're here to encourage dialogue, and who would have thought, that a place that, must have featured the dinosaurs, can also maybe spark, kind of a new approach to how someone might live their life here in our city. So,
yeah,
just outstanding.
I'll share an exhibit that we had a few years ago. Just when we talk about dinosaurs, we had an exhibit, Darwin and Dinosaurs. And so we, talked about evolution and how the discovery of the first full dinosaur skeleton, which, by the way, was found by a woman, Mary Anning. And so we could even talk about Mary Anning and a poor woman who made her living selling fossils, collecting fossils that men presented in the science community. And so there's ways to use dinosaurs that can talk about other issues that are still relevant today.
I am learning so much. Oh my gosh, I can't begin to tell you. Okay. I could go down that rabbit hole for another 30 minutes, but
right.
We'll stay on track.
And it was the discovery of this, at the time they thought it was a large fish living in the ocean. They didn't understand dinosaurs, but it was through that Darwin started, that was what kind of motivated or inspired what became his theory of evolution. So it was this discovery that over many, many, hundreds or thousands of years, this mammal, this dinosaur had evolved. And so, there's lots of ways that we can use the things that are comfortable for us, so the dinosaurs, and that are exciting, and weave them into other messages and other education into those as well. So sometimes it's just cool to have fun and have a big dinosaur, roaring in your face. And hey, there's a lot of value in that. And sometimes we can use it to communicate other messages and to be able to present other science and history that you might not expect.
I am certain that our InnovateJax audience is going to walk through these doors on their next visit with a whole new appreciation for what they're coming to. So that's amazing. All right. We have to move on and ask you. We were lucky enough to interview Donna Orender in episode 4 with Generation W, and at her 2019 event, there you were at Generation W
in your pink pants.
Love it. And you led a conversation. I'm guessing you had a conversation with the audience, which is always so much fun there. So can you tell us a little bit about the message that you shared there that day?
Yeah, that was. Shawana Brooks facilitated that, and it was Cindy Edelman and Joy Young, and it was a little free flow, but essentially the role of arts and culture and community building and social justice, and how important we are as cultural institutions or as individual artists, that how art and culture are vehicles for social change, for social justice, for community issues, dialogue. And so it was really, what are some of the strategies that we've used? What are some of the experiences that we've had collectively? One of Jacksonville's strengths is that it is such a collaborative cultural community. And that has been very intentional over the last 10 years. And so that was part of the conversation, was the sort of the power, the collective impact is, it takes more work up front, but the power of collaboration is really how the cultural community in Jacksonville sees impact happening. And I'm passionate about it. I'm on fire about it. And so it was really fun to sit with those other women and just kind of free flow talk about these things that we all are so engaged in and really committed to, building Jacksonville's cultural community in a way that it is knit into our everyday lives and the challenges and the important dialogues that we need to have and the social justice concerns. And you know, we all have a place in that. We all have a responsibility in that. And we all have platforms in our different areas of influence, and so for all of us, it's, you know, the cultural platform in some way or another. So
Maria, do you have a gold standard? Is there a particular city that's really doing it right, really leveraging its cultural and artistic resources for those goals that you just mentioned? Or even an individual, I can't speak to those goals.
I can say from a cultural perspective of really leveraging art as an economic driver for a city, which when it comes down to it, that's what's going to be important to our Chamber of Commerce and to City Hall, is how is this an economic driver? So St. Petersburg has done an outstanding job of identifying themselves, of investing dollars into their cultural and arts community, of marketing what they have, of really leveraging what they have. Jacksonville has so many of those same things. St. Petersburg has just been very intentional to identify that, to create an identity around that, and then invest in it. And so that's a great example. There are many cities that are great examples. Mm-hmm. Some of them, you know, you could look at Taos that people instantly think of, you know, arts and culture and sort of more of an artist kind of community. But we're all working together, I think, on identity for Jacksonville, but that's definitely one of its strengths. And but St. Petersburg would be, I think, a really good example. And sort of, I think they made that choice, and you can read the books that the past mayor's written about that intention. So it was an economic driver, but it also comes with art as an expression. So when we talk about what some of those other values are, they just become knit and integrated into it. So I don't think you end up with one without the other.
And in such an organic way.
Yeah.
You know, nothing forces it. So, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, I could talk to you for another 20 minutes just about that. Oh my goodness. All right. Well, in trying to keep myself on track, I look back over your career and you've had so many influential roles in so many different parts of the city. But I wonder, from being in the private sector and the public sector, where do you feel that you can have more impact? And what advice might you have for someone, especially women, mm-hmm. who are looking to leave their mark regardless of where they are?
Yeah. So I love that question. It really makes me think about what is that answer? Where do you, is it public service? Is it corporate work? Is it, is it nonprofit? And where as a leader do you best see yourself in, in the mix? I read this article, I think it was in the Harvard, and it talked about the three different types of, about the movement and three types of leadership that every successful movement must have. And I'm probably not going to get them exactly right, but it's the agitator. You need the person that's like calling attention to the awareness, and not all of us embody that, but some people are great at that. And then there's the logistics person about, just what are the logistics of the movement? And then there's the person, just the people doing the work. And so you can't have only one for a movement or to make change. You've got to have this kind of trifecta of types of leaders. And so there's when you're maybe more of a quiet leader, sometimes you may not feel like you have as much impact. So you don't have to be an elected official. If that's your gift, then by all means, use your gift. but I don't know that it's one or the other. What I'm trying to say is that there's a place for all types of leadership, and they are all important for change and for movement and for impact. And so it's really, I think this word's maybe been overused, but it's the right word. It's really, where are you authentically contributing and using your strengths in a way that is better for others, making space better for others, creating policymakers, there's the doers, there's a place for all of those, but it's not one or the other. There's not one or the other that is more impactful. Just I think it's Mark Twain quote. I'm going to butcher it, but the gist of it, and it just so sticks with me, is something close to there's so much room for impact if you're not worried about who gets the credit.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think about that a lot.
It's a very humble approach, but obviously something that's driven you and in all the roles you've held here. All right, Maria, another question for you. Mm-hmm. Again, you've been so deeply involved in so many different parts of our city and shaping where it is. Mm-hmm. Can you look back and tell me, what do you see as the most transformative or defining moments?
Yes. The passage of the HRO, I think, was a critically defining moment for Jacksonville. 50 years ago, consolidation was a defining moment. The two are, I think, married in a way that consolidation, intentional, not intentional, whatever, but it broke up communities and neighborhoods, and it redefined, the neighborhoods of Jacksonville, the landscape. I think at that time, that now 50 years later, I think the HRO helped to bring together some of those segregations and either intentional or non-intentional divides and conflict.
Can I ask you to define what HRO was for folks who may not be as familiar with it?
Jacksonville passed a human rights ordinance in city council. Was that 3 years ago?
Okay. Yeah. All right. Very good. All right. Well, so if that's where we've been, Maria, where do we need to go?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I am crazy excited about Jacksonville and where it is just tottering, and we're just about to in spite of ourselves, explode. And I just love that so much. I think there's where do we go as a city? I think we've got some really
really strong city leaders right now that some folks, not just in elected office, but as community leaders that have a really strong vision. And I'm really, really excited to see that. I think this Lori Boyer really driving the focus on the river and just taking a very strong leadership role. I think so many in Jacksonville want that and could articulate that, but just somebody has to be the leader. And she's just really taken that and is driving with a lot of energy behind that. And so I'm very excited about her role in the downtown and DIA and said that she really can drive that further. I think that we're still sort of challenged by defining who we are around inclusivity, about defining what inclusivity means to us as a city and practicing what inclusivity means as a city. The HRO is a big part of that. And I think Jacksonville is sort of still struggling with what does that value mean and what are our behaviors and our practices that are aligned or not. The other thing that I think we have a great vision, but Jacksonville, I think, is, in my opinion, a risk-averse city. And so really just let's spend the money, let's fund our schools, let's fund arts and, you know, arts and culture. Let's invest in the city that we want. That, Amy, everybody hears it at work all the time. Let's move our heads from austerity to abundance. And I don't mean let's spend like crazy, but let's think about ourselves in an abundant way. And then let's figure out how to fund it, but not being afraid to fund and to tax what we want to see happen in Jacksonville.
I might just have to do a follow-up with you because I feel like we just scratched the surface. Really? So.
Well, that's kind.
All right.
I appreciate
Thank you so
it.
Much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Furcura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Furcura.com. Thanks for listening.